Today on Against the Grain. Universities are one of the most hallowed institutions in our society. The critics argue they're closer to hedge funds that conduct classes. Higher education is largely tax exempt, based on the idea that universities benefit the public at large, including the communities where they're located. Yet urbanist and historian Devarian Baldwin argues that cities pay a very high price for universities, which, whether public or private, are engines of profit, encroaching on adjacent communities and exploiting low-wage labor, while grossly subsidized by their host cities. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Universities are companies, and their host cities are company towns. Suffering from a starved tax base, high housing costs and displacement, and often the abuses of campus police. So argues Devarian Baldwin, professor of American Studies and founder of the Smart Cities Lab at Trinity College. His book, In the Shadow of the Ivory Tower, How Universities Are Plundering Our Cities, which is published by Bold Type Books, asserts that universities have come to dominate U.S. cities, both large and small, but that their outsized impact often flies under the radar because of universities' nonprofit status and generically benign image. Universities are presumed to operate for the public good, generating research that furthers the knowledge of humanity while educating the next generation. Devarian, what's wrong, in your opinion, with the assumption that higher education operates fully in the public interest?
Well, first of all, let me just concede that, yes, universities do amazing things. They produce new research, they make innovations. But with that, we have ceded significant levels of political and economic power to these institutions at a time when higher education has taken on a greater role in society. And so what I'm saying by this is that with this greater power, with this presumption of universities serving the public good, we have given up a significant level of influence to these institutions in ways that we probably never have even imagined. So for example, it's colleges and universities that have become the biggest employers, real estate owners, healthcare providers, and even policing agents in major cities and towns all across the country. And that's come from the fact that we presume that they are working in the public good. But in that process, we have lost our autonomy and control over society in significant ways.
Some universities are private and others are public, yet most are considered nonprofits. Can you explain that, the tax status of universities, whether they're public or private, and how that relates to for-profit research and other such activities that they may engage in?
One of the clearest indicators of higher education's public good status is its nonprofit tax-exempt identity, as exemplified by their status as a 501c3 in the tax code. This comes from the fact that we argue that, society argues that, because the universities do things that would normally have to be done by the government, they should be compensated. They provide education, was the original intent. And so because of that, their property is tax exempt. On top of that, their endowments are also tax exempt, so they can go about doing the business that serves the public good. But the irony of that is that as we have moved into 21st century, where we live in a world without factories, the very condition or the very terms of their tax-exempt status has become the avenue whereby they've been able to hoard, concentrate, consolidate power in terms of land, labor, and political control. If you think about it, these institutions are today's factories, and our communities have become their factory towns. We think about what are the primary industries that are generating or powering our society today: medical tech, bioscience, military defense weaponry, all these post-product, deindustrialized entities, most of the work that gets done in these industries takes place on campuses. So then what happens if the very work that's done there is hidden under higher education's tax-exempt shelter because they're presumed to offer a public good? But this work is not offering any public good for us at all. It's actually consolidating power, wealth, and influence for higher education and their private partners. This is important because it impacts both public and private universities. The really today, the only difference between a public and a private university is name only, because so many public universities only receive about between 10 and 12% of their support, their starter support, from the state. So all these schools have tried to figure out different ways to become entrepreneurial. And this is why they've invested in these all these different realms of private investment and profitable research.
And we'll talk much more as we go on about all those ways that that's been taking place, that universities have filled the gap from reduced state funding by generating revenues in all sorts of manners. But many of the powerful universities in the United States are centuries old. I wonder, though, if you could trace the place of universities in cities through the 20th century and into the 21st as the fortunes of American cities have waxed and waned.
That's a great question. In the early 20th century, universities were located in areas that were not actually even fully industrial. They weren't actually a part of the city. They were on the outskirts of the city. So if you think about Cambridge, Massachusetts, or South Central in Los Angeles, or Hyde Park in Chicago, or even my home institution of Trinity College, it was in the Frog Hollow area of Hartford, Connecticut. These were all areas that were outside of the central core city because it was thought that, you know, industrial areas corrupt, and we want to send our best and brightest to these kind of pastoral reserves outside of the city to be educated free from the constraints and the corruption of the industrializing city. But over the 20th century, these areas became incorporated into the city so that those neighborhoods were central core features of the city. By the time we get to the mid 20th century, however, you see what's been called white flight. The white ethnic individuals leaving the city, chasing down suburbanization and the wealth that went into the suburbs. At the very same moment that largely black and brown residents were coming from the South or from Mexico or Latin America to live in cities in the areas that were surrounding these campus areas. So in that time period, universities, their response was to fortify, to create boundaries, to get money from urban renewal policy, to create separation between their campuses and increasingly darkening neighborhoods surrounding the campus. But then by the time we get to the 1990s and the 2000s, things begin to change. We see a new interest in returning back to the city. The grandchildren of those who sought their fortunes in the areas of suburban sprawl, they wanted to return back to the city, what we call the Back to the City movement. And so you begin to see municipal and state investments in things like tech design, where large warehouses were being converted into loft housing. Web design companies were coming into the city, and they were trying, different cities were competing with each other for young professionals and even empty nesters who wanted to come back into the city. And universities were central to that because their idea of an urban life was largely a campus. Walkability, fully wired, coffee shops, lectures, museums. And so universities took on this greater import in the late 20th century, moving into the 21st century, as this fulcrum, this anchor to attract and generate those who wanted to come back into the cities and for city leaders to compete with each other for this tax base. As this happens, you begin to see a new level of investment in universities, what I call the rise of the university, whereby public and private investments in these campuses as the centerpiece of urban life became also the anchor for our deindustrializing economy. And in this moment, higher education was no longer just simply the ivory tower separated from the life up on the hill. It became the driving engine for our political economy. And this is the story I talk about in the book. What happened when higher education became this driving force in our economy at the very same moment when we could continue to talk about higher education as just simply a place that taught classes?
Right. So you are describing, in a sense, the intersection of several things, which is the return of elites to city centers, the promise that universities make cities of attracting the creative class, having all of that quality of life stuff that a lot of upper middle class and upper class people find desirable. And at the same time, universities are facing a reduction in funding. So at this moment, as these sort of different forces intersect, can you tell us about the ways that universities have responded? Now, some of these predate this moment, but I imagine are accelerated through it. Can you talk about the push, which has long been controversial, of universities to expand their campuses into the neighborhoods around them, which, at least since the mid-20th century, when you were describing how cities were abandoned, these areas often were areas that low-income people and people of color lived in?
You know, by the time we get to the 90s and 2000s, you have two important forces that are going on. You have this Back to the City movement, and you have city leaders competing with each other to try to grab that tax base. It's also young professionals and empty nest retirees who want to come back to the city at a time when they're bored with suburban sprawl. And so with that, you have these urban city leaders looking for new ways to attract them. And as I said before, one of the main things they were trying to retrofit their neighborhoods that were largely filled with Black and brown residents into what was imagined as like a campus-like. And on the other side, you have universities facing drastic cuts from state contributions. So at a school like, you know, UC Berkeley, for example, in your area, or a state school like University of Michigan or University of Virginia, the contribution from the state drops from, say, 70% to 10 or 12%. So they become basically public universities in name only. So in this moment, you have a period of what I call interest convergence between city leaders looking for ways to turn their cities into attractive draws for returnees. And on the other side, you have universities looking for new revenue streams, becoming what was at the time and what we still call them, becoming more entrepreneurial. The key word that we use today is innovation. So these two interests converge, and they converge around the idea of what will it mean to turn the city into a campus. And this process has profound impact for the longstanding Black, brown, and poor white neighborhoods that largely surround campuses. Because as these campuses become the centerpiece of these new cities, as the engine for new university economic development, they expand into these neighborhoods that have been historically repressed. The land is relatively cheap, and the residents have little political power to stop them. And so whole neighborhood blocks become retrofitted into some version of a campus. And we can see this, you know, in parts of Berkeley, the South Berkeley. That whole area got expanded in the 80s and 90s, and it's still happening today. We can see Wake Forest taking over downtown Winston-Salem and building an innovation quarter. We can see the new ASU campus in Mesa, Arizona. We can see the University of Miami building their Miami Converge campus in the historically Black and brown neighborhoods of Overtown and Alapata. We can see Penn building its UCity Square in the historically Black neighborhood of West Philadelphia. This is a phenomenon happening all over the country. It's being celebrated as revitalizing the city, but it has dire consequences for the longstanding residents of these communities, what we might call gentrification. But the real word here is displacement.
Devarian Baldwin is my guest. He is the author of In the Shadow of the Ivory Tower, How Universities Are Plundering Our Cities. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, I wonder if you could talk about your own university, the liberal arts institution, Trinity College, which is located in Hartford, Connecticut. For listeners who don't know, can you describe the city and the place of Trinity in it?
Sure. Hartford, Connecticut is a long-standing factory town. It is situated in the middle of what we might call the armory corridor, the home of places like Colt Firearms, Smith & Wesson in Springfield, Massachusetts, and other armories. And so it had done that work in the late 1800s and throughout the early to mid-1900s. But by the time we get to the 1950s and 60s in the period of white flight and suburbanization, it undergoes similar processes. And Trinity is situated in the middle of that phenomenon. It is an elite, small liberal arts college. It was the educator of, it's considered a finishing school. It was a feeder school into the very elite old school preps and boarding schools like Andover Prep, Deerfield Academy, Choate, Suffield Academy. These schools go back, they're older than some of the states in the Union. And so Trinity was a feeder school to those prep schools, and it sits literally up on a hill in the middle of Hartford. And in the story that I told earlier, it was situated in downtown Hartford in the 1800s. But in the early 20th century, it moved to an outer ring neighborhood called Frog Hollow that hadn't fully been incorporated into the city of Hartford. But as industrialization washes over the city of Hartford, that neighborhood gets pulled into the city of Hartford. And so it, in this, throughout the 20th century, Trinity positioned itself as being in Hartford, but not of Hartford. And by the mid to late 20th century, as the neighborhoods change and white ethnics leave the city of Hartford, and West Indian and Latinx residents come into the city of Hartford to surround Trinity, the university fortifies itself. It builds a fence around itself. Again, it considered moving out of Hartford, but it always saw itself as being a liberal arts college that was, again, in but not of. But by the 1980s and 90s, the reputation of the institution was being impacted by the poverty and relative violence that was surrounding the campus. So a president by the name of Ed Dobell took a very radical step and began to engage in what he called enlightened self-interest, and began to build out projects in the city of Hartford because he understood that the reputation of the campus was tied to the city of Hartford. But in some cases, his efforts, his mouth was bigger than his follow-through. And so there are these projects that still stand in mid-formation to this day that were never completed. And the city of Hartford has a lot of growing pains and hurt feelings around that. But Hartford and Trinity have always had this relationship whereby the city of Hartford is proud that Trinity is here, and Hartford and Trinity remains ambivalent about its place in the city of Hartford, a working class, now largely poor, brown city. And so there's always been this dance between Trinity and Hartford about what it means for it to be an urban liberal arts campus. For many years, it didn't want to be tied to Hartford. But now in the 21st century, Trinity College is facing a competition with a shrinking recruitment base. Fewer kids are going to school. Kids don't want to pay that $80,000 a year price tag to go to Trinity. And so after years of being ambivalent about being in the city, now the university has rebranded itself as a liberal arts college in the capital city. And so now we struggle with, will that be a branding title in name only, or will it actually be a true act of urban and community engagement with the communities that surround the campus? And it is a struggle and a name and an identity that we are struggling with up to the present.
Right, the contradictions and tensions of universities doing their utmost to attract as you say, a shrinking pool of potential applicants and trying to sort of boost themselves up as world-class institutions with all sorts of amenities that then sprawl into their host cities has created a number of different flashpoints. I wonder if you could talk about New York University, NYU, which has become, in many ways, as famous for its real estate developments as for the university itself. Can you tell us about the ways that NYU has shaped the parts of New York City that it's in, especially Greenwich Village?
Yeah. Early on, and even to this day, it's shaping so demonstrably its Greenwich Village neighborhood around the iconic Washington Square Park. For years, NYU had been lauded as being this institution that was interspersed throughout the city, that you couldn't tell an NYU building from a city building. But there were all these ways in which that's not true. I went to NYU for graduate school. I know this community very well. There were ways in which its landscaping and its flags on the buildings made it very clear. Even the cobblestones on the streets made it clear when you entered into the campus, even in a muted formation. I spent time talking to Matthew Broderick, the actor who grew up in Greenwich Village. And he talked about, you know, in the 80s and 90s, witnessing, you know, blocks that had public playgrounds and Washington Square Park being open to everybody, slowly becoming a part of the campus. Public spaces being torn down and being replaced with buildings. Buildings that were publicly accessible being covered with purple flags, the violet flags, which is the color of the campus of the university. So this is a story that we see quite well. In the time period of the 2000s, as the university began to sprawl out, because as you mentioned before, it's been known as a real estate company that also just happens to conduct classes. That's what people know it as in some ways. It has a small endowment compared to some of the big elite Ivy League schools. And so it's tried to maintain its competitive edge by buying up significant properties. Between NYU and Columbia, for years, they were the second and third largest real estate holders on the island of Manhattan outside of the Catholic Church. And that is where NYU's wealth largely lies. But it also has, because of its real estate power in a real estate city like New York, it has significant political power. And so as it tried to build up and build out, unlike, say, Columbia in a more economically depressed and politically weaker Harlem, New York, NYU was in Greenwich Village, elite, wealthy, white neighbors that had been able to push back. But yet still, they still couldn't push back against NYU when it wanted to build up and break zoning codes and height restrictions. It's been able to, over the years, win the favor of the city council, of political figures, and simply just break codes. Your listeners might know the iconic battles between Jane Jacobs and Robert Moses.
Sure.
And people don't realize that battle happened in Greenwich Village. A lot of that battle was over NYU's efforts to try to take over Washington Square Park, trying to put a highway right in the middle of the park, where the park sits. So NYU's been the center of these battles over the cities for decades. But residents were able to win and push back. But in the 2000s, in the last 20 years, NYU has been able to push back against those victories and go against height restrictions, go against zoning ordinances that argued that certain neighborhoods could only, certain buildings, could, certain blocks could only be used for residential properties, and they've been able to put in university buildings. And so this is the story of NYU. I've talked to the Historic Preservation Society, long-term residents, and they just are saddened by watching the victories that they've been able to achieve over the years be rolled back by the increasing power of NYU over Greenwich Village. And as you might know, now their campus, they have a Brooklyn campus, they have a medical campus in Midtown. And they've been able to franchise, like McDonald's, franchise the NYU brand with branches in Abu Dhabi and Shanghai. And so NYU, as they've said, you know, its mascot is the Violets. They've been known now as the purple people eater. Because if they can't generate the wealth in New York, they've gone global and they've been able to bring that wealth and that power back to NYU. And they've been able to override long-term agreements and zoning ordinances to get what they want.
Well, you mentioned a few minutes ago Columbia University, which of course was the site of famous protests in 1968 over a proposed gymnasium in Morningside Heights. Does the echoes of history of those previous upheavals give pause to universities now, or do they just push ahead like I guess they have done in Greenwich Village against even more powerful?
That's a great question. Yeah, it's funny. I wish I could say it has forced them to pause. I think it's just forced them to get smarter in their branding. So in the case of Columbia, as they began to build out what's now their Manhattanville campus, right in the middle of West Harlem, they were very savvy to say, yes, we understand the ghosts of 68 are here, but we're better now. But what they're better meant was actually using eminent domain to push long-term homeowners and small businesses out of West Harlem to expand this campus. This is what's been the reality. They argue that we're going to build out, you know, parks for the campus, for the community to use, but they're surrounded by Columbia University police to police the behavior of residents in these areas. They talked about, yes, the bottom floor of these new buildings will have, you know, free Wi-Fi or access to classes and things of this nature. But what they've essentially done is they privatized greater swaths of what they're calling Manhattanville, which is really West Harlem. This has become the story. This is the reality. They've said that, well, we're in these buildings, we are creating, you know, world historic discoveries. But what they don't talk about is that these buildings move into West Harlem, property values are going up because investors are following. Investors, they watch, they see where campuses are moving, and they build out private developments of housing and retail to meet the needs of the young professionals that will follow into these campus areas. And this pushes out longstanding residents of Harlem, of Greenwich Village, of South Side of Chicago, of South Central LA, of North St. Louis, of Southwest Atlanta, of East Baltimore. This is a story that we see all over the country as these campuses sprawl into these neighborhoods. Even if they don't directly demolish or push out the campuses, you have this root shock effect. What the scholar Wendy Fullove calls the root shock effect, that there are these ripples where investors follow and price points rise above the capacity of working class residents or even those black and brown members, those longstanding aunties and uncles who are able to buy a home. They're on a fixed income though. And so then as property values rise, they can't pay the increased property taxes that might push them out. And this is what's happening in Harlem, as it's happening in many neighborhoods all across the country. And Columbia celebrates itself as revitalizing neighborhoods. But the question has to be, for whom? They say we're doing community engagement. The question becomes, well, who is the community? Is the community the longstanding residents that were there for decades that maintained a neighborhood when it was rife with violence and poverty? Or is the community those new residents that the university wants to attract and do the creative class knowledge work that will drive their prosperity? That's the question we must ask.
Devarian Baldwin is my guest. He's professor of American Studies and founder of the Smart Cities Lab at Trinity College. We're talking about his book, In the Shadow of the Ivory Tower, How Universities Are Plundering Our Cities, which is published by Bold Type Books. You can find a link to that book at againstthegrain.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Policing is yet another way that universities have negatively affected the communities in which they're located. I wonder if you could first explain for us the private police forces that some universities have and what jurisdictions they can be allowed to police.
So as quiet as it's kept, both public and private, most schools have campus police, 75%. nearly all carry guns, and about 9 in 10 have arrest and patrol jurisdictions beyond their main campus. So that's just the reality. The idea is that these police agents, and I'm not talking about police, public safety. I'm talking about police departments. So fully sanctioned, again, with the power to arrest non-university affiliates. Now, the idea behind this, the marketing, is that these can become agents of student and community safety. That's the idea, that they can help city and town police in the act of public safety. But when we look at the primary role or the primary responsibility of campus police, to police the campus, they are an utter failure. What are the major crimes that happen on campuses? Sexual violence, substance abuse, and petty theft. They do not police that well at all. Many campuses are rampant with acts of sexual violence. So the question becomes, what are they doing? Why are they under-policing their campuses, but then over-policing the neighborhoods that surround these campuses? The issue here is university branding. Because what predominantly white institution wants to identify to the world that they have a campus full of white criminals? So the job is to police and protect the university brand. So on one side, to say that the campus is fun and kids can do what they want, but at the same time, off campus, saying to outside investors and to students and to their families that the neighborhoods where these campuses sit are safe for your investment, safe to live, safe to party, safe to have fun. And so this is the reality, both in public and private universities. And this is an important point to realize, that there's an additional power for a private university police force. Because if you don't know, private entities in the US are exempt from Freedom of Information Act laws. This reality gets compounded with a private university because that FOIA exemption is transferred to their private campus police forces. So not only are these private campus police departments, not only are they private police forces, but they have public authority to arrest and detain on and off campus. But they have the power to do this without public oversight. So this is, in my mind, criminal. So in the case of Johns Hopkins University, just a couple of years ago, we're trying to push forward their own private police department using the University of Chicago as their model. Residents in the areas surrounding the campus in Baltimore pushed back significantly. The state senator, Mary Washington, she looked at this askance and she described it as like putting a Vatican City in the middle of Baltimore. Because this private campus, this private university, now with its own private police force, would be basically an independent republic with its own capacity to enforce its own laws and only answer to the university president and the board of trustees. And you're seeing this phenomenon happening all over the country, especially as universities are engaging in tech and pharmaceutical investments on these tax-exempt campus of land. These police forces are serving as the frontline security forces in the concentration of wealth on these campuses.
Well, tell us more about that expansion of tech and of medical schools and connected facilities to that. Obviously, that's a highly profitable part of the U.S. economy. How does that play out in universities and in the communities they're sited in? What are the impacts?
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, as the nation has shifted from assembly line, mass industrialized production to what we call the knowledge economy. Now, the knowledge economy, in short, is where academic research is used to create profitable commercial goods or patents in a range of fields, from pharmaceuticals and software products to life science services and military defense weaponry. Not surprisingly, where is this work being done? It's being done largely in the workshops and laboratories on campuses. But the additional rub here is that because this work is being done on campuses, that work reduces overhead costs for the private investors because campus land is property tax exempt. So you're finding GM, General Motors, Bombardier, Microsoft, Google. If you look at most campuses, you'll see that branding all on these campuses because they understand from an economic standpoint, it is profitable to partner with a university to do work on these campus lands. On top of that, you also get the cheap labor of graduate students without having to pay them competitive costs that you have to pay if they were directly employed by the industry. Now, the primary harm here is that, what do property tax funds go to? Property taxes go primarily to fund things like secondary schools, snow removal, trash removal, the maintenance of the electrical grid, public works like maintaining bridges, roads, tunnels. So what does it mean then when your biggest employer and your landholder and your magnet for private investment is also property tax exempt? Then the burden of those services and the maintenance of the city is not met. And the very prosperity that is generated on these campuses comes largely from the taxes that they don't pay to the city. And yet they benefit from the schools. They benefit from the infrastructure that comes from property taxes that they don't pay. And again, that burden is passed on to the community, to the residents that surround the campuses. So this is why you have, for example, I was organizing with activists and residents in New Haven, Connecticut. They have students taking classes in bathrooms or in hallways, 5 and 10 year old textbooks, because the biggest landholder employer in the city of New Haven, Yale University, doesn't pay taxes. This is a phenomenon that's going on all over the country. So this is why residents and activists and community members are arguing that universities need to pay their fair share. They're calling for pilots, payments in lieu of taxes, to try to right the wrongs of this horrible gray area around taxation that actually helps generate wealth in this knowledge economy, because it's largely happening on these campuses. So these buildings of glass and steel that we celebrate, we don't talk enough about how that prosperity is coming from the impoverishment, the extraction of wealth from the host communities.
Well, let me ask you more about that, because as you say, this is definitely an area of great contention in many cities. You mentioned New Haven, which houses Yale. I know that in Ithaca, New York, where Cornell is located, this is an enormous issue, since the residents of the city end up subsidizing the university. Having studied the impact of universities on cities, how do you think residents can generate adequate leverage over powerful universities to force them to pay more, given that whatever they do pay tends to be voluntary and, you know, really is a fraction of the amount that the universities actually cost the cities?
That's a great question. I mean, at the foundation of it all is social movement organizing. That's the only way it's going to work. Social movement organizing. And so you mentioned the voluntary process, and I mentioned it briefly. A pilot is a payment in lieu of taxes, because every state has designated nonprofits as tax exempt. You have to understand, schools like Yale or Harvard, they have $50 billion dollar endowments. And that doesn't even include the revenues generated from their real estate portfolio. Doesn't even include that. So the ways in which we can create leverage is, one way is what we call the calling for pilots, payment in lieu of taxes. And that's happened across the country, whereby cities or labor unions or community groups, and you mentioned Ithaca, through my lab, I'm talking to community groups and labor unions in Baltimore, in New Haven, in Ithaca, as we speak in St. Louis, to call for pilots. That's one way. In historically Black communities, you're seeing a growing, you might be familiar with the calls for reparations from slavery.
Sure.
But because of my work, and I've talked about this in my work, they're also trying to move the reparations conversation to the 20th century and specifically talk about the role, the impact that higher education has played in the period of urban renewal, in the period of policing, in the period of gentrification, and talking about how a reparations politics can be used to make universities pay, to make them more equitable community neighbors. Another thing that people don't know is that the only reason why universities exist, even though we see now, we laud them as being a contributor in economically depressed times, but the only reason why they exist is because of state charters. We give them the power to exist, both public and private universities. So I'm calling for, if universities do not pay their fair share, if they don't serve as good neighbors, to revoke their state charter. It's a big call, but it's something I think we can do. Also, on top of pilots, we can negotiate and call for community benefits agreements. And we've seen bits and pieces of this as football and basketball stadiums come into neighborhoods and sometimes universities. We call for community benefits agreements, whereby these things can include, say, paying a pilot, or open access to community facilities and spaces, or building affordable housing as the university expands into the neighborhood. So for all the high-end residential dormitories that they build for their wealthy students, portions of the land should be reserved for residential affordable housing. We can call for equitable wages. We have to remember that universities are sometimes, and many times, the biggest employer in their communities, and not faculty employer, but low-wage employer in terms of cafeteria work, groundskeeping work, security, support staff. So we can call for living wages. We can call, because if you don't know, even though there are many workers that work for universities, they only work 9 months out of the year. So they can have a full-time job and still be eligible for public assistance. And again, people don't know this because universities are seen as inherently a public good. But the public good has been a guise, has become a mechanism by which universities can engage in unfair labor practices, unfair real estate practices, unfair policing practices. We don't ask the questions because we assume that they're doing good work. And so through my lab, I've been working with community groups all over the country to figure out strategies and practices to make universities come to the table and be more equitable neighbors. Because no one wants a university to lead. We want universities in our neighborhoods. We want them to be equitable partners. So things like pilots, community benefits agreements, discussions around the state charter. In the Bay Area, there were discussions around making UC Berkeley live up to its long range development plan by suing the university. The neighborhood of Witherspoon Jackson in Princeton, New Jersey, residents put together a lawsuit because they realized that the partnership between Princeton University and the pharmaceutical giant Eli Lilly was generating millions of dollars on that campus, but the property tax exempt burden was being passed on to homeowners in that community. So they sued Princeton University and won an $18 million lawsuit for tax relief. In the South Side of Chicago, you have activists that are fighting against the Obama Library, which is partnered with the University of Chicago, because when that library was announced, private developers and real estate moguls moved into the economically depressed neighborhood of Woodlawn, and housing values and land values skyrocketed above the means of longstanding residents. So they've been pushing for a community benefits agreement. They've been pushing for an affordable housing land trust so that any new development that will be put in that neighborhood, a portion of the wealth generated from that development would go into an affordable housing land trust so that the residents would not just be able to watch as development pushes them out, but they'd be able to stay. So these are some of the things that we're fighting for, that we're pushing for, and in some neighborhoods winning. But there's so much more we can do.
You mentioned of course, that these universities are all dependent on low-wage workers. And I wanted to ask you about organizing by those workers and others who are protesting the displacement or the subsidization of the university by the city's residents, you know, both homeowners and renters, because that gets passed on to them. Unlike some struggles against bad actors, it seems that one thing that the activists have in their favor is that the universities, especially universities who've been there for decades or centuries, can't get up and move. Do you think that is something that can be used to affect by activists and others?
Yes, definitely. Part of the, you know, as we moved into the knowledge economy, part of the branding of universities is their location. Because if you look at what they offer, it's all the same. But they try to compete on the higher ed marketplace, partially by the location where they exist, New York, you know, Los Angeles, Atlanta, what have you. And that actually puts them in a position of being vulnerable because of those communities and the workers that surround them. Maybe your listeners, you know, are probably familiar with, like, in the last couple of years, we've been seeing a higher education strike wave, you know, wash across the country, primarily driven by graduate students. Because what we don't realize is that while graduate students get a stipend, they live in these very expensive cities, and the university benefits from these graduate students having suppressed wages, and many times having to depend on the university for their housing. So the university receives revenues coming and going. Even if they provide a stipend, they get it back in the form of housing, because in a city like New York or Chicago, real estate moguls won't rent to graduate students because they don't feel that they are a safe and stable a renter. So then the universities have a captive market, a real estate market, and they will not, even though they actually have owned these properties for decades and don't actually need to sell it at market rate, they rent out to graduate students at market rates, even they don't have to, and name themselves as doing the work in the public good. So we've seen a strike wave across the country, primarily by graduate students, but also some undergraduates even who work in cafeterias and on the grounds are engaging in strike waves. And I've done the analysis around this, and I'm in my work with New Haven Rising in New Haven, Connecticut, we realized that the university is powerful, but it's vulnerable because it has its tentacles in so many areas of our lives that has nothing to do with teaching classes. Again, healthcare, policing, labor, land control, endowment work. And if the residents and the workers in all these areas turn away from the university for their values and turn to each other, there's power in that. And New Haven Rising was so powerful, and it was able to bring Yale to the table because it was a coalition of workers who primarily worked at Yale, residents who lived in the city of New Haven, who lived in Yale properties, residents who were policed by Yale PD, students who went to the university, turning together with people like me, scholars who do this work, and building a coalition and offering an analysis that made visible all the ways in which Yale was encroaching on everyday life that was not about classrooms or pure research. And as we did that analysis, it became very powerful. I called it, and I'm on the National Council of the American Association of University Professors, which is basically our labor union. And I offer this analysis that we are pushing for what we call the new shop floor, that these universities are dependent not just on their main campus, but their tentacles in these surrounding communities. And so as we organize, we have to move beyond just simply labor wages and benefits. We must also organize around equitable housing, around community benefits agreements, around pilots, around all the ways in which the university impacts us. Because if you organize just in just one way, the university will turn and extract and exploit in another area. So you have to have an expansive understanding of their power, what I call the new shop floor, so that everywhere they turn, we're there. And that's the reason why New Haven Rising was able to win.
So you're describing a situation where all these struggles are linked up together. The teachers' unions whose schools have been starved of funds, and the residents and the workers. But ending with a question on tactics, in looking at situations where people have succeeded, do you think it's enough to try and tarnish the image of the university? Obviously, they are very image conscious. Or do you think that in some sense that can be brushed off and that more direct kinds of action and activism are necessary?
Definitely. I think the image issue is important because universities are so dependent on branding. So by just simply making visible their impact in policing and the violence that goes on in their name, the deaths that have come at the hands of university police or just the daily forms of harassment, that's powerful. But the only way this works is by direct action organizing. So what you see right now around People's Park in Berkeley, California, or what you see with the strike waves, actually shutting down, holding labor power, holding back your labor power. Or in New Haven, weekly rallies. But again, it's a combination of the image war and the direct action war. In the rallies, we're making visible how much money the university would owe if they actually paid their taxes. And we're doing it by doing door knocking and sit-ins and die-ins and walk-arounds. During the pandemic, the Democratic Socialists of America's student chapter at Columbia, they withheld their tuition because they were like, why are we paying full tuition and we're learning remotely? But they didn't stop there. They said, not only do we want equitable tuition, but we want the university to do better in the Harlem campus where they're building out their Manhattanville campus and its impact on West Harlem residents. So again, these linked fate organizing through sit-ins, teach-ins, rallies, labor stoppage, protests, image campaigns, media assaults, all these things have to work hand in hand for this to work.
Devarian Baldwin, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you.
I've been speaking with urbanist, historian, and cultural critic about his book, In the Shadow of the Ivory Tower, How Universities Are Plundering Our Cities. You can find a link to that book at our website, againstthegrain.org. Devarian Baldwin is professor of American Studies at Trinity College and also the author of Chicago's New Negroes, Modernity, the Great Migration, and Black Urban Life. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.